Hey friends, welcome to Worry Less, Wag More. This is the Behavior Vets Podcast. I'm your host, Ferdy Yap. Join me to dive into the thrills and challenges of treating pet behavior issues. I'll shine a light on science-based training that's effective and brings us closer to understanding the animals we share our lives with. Hi everyone, my guest today is the extremely talented author, dog trainer, freelance writer, and multimedia educator, Sassafras Lowry. Sassafras is a leader in competitive trick training and author of the dog training books Tricks in the City and Chew This Journal. Her work regularly appears in dog magazines like Dogster, The Bark, Modern Dog, The American Kennel Club, as well as other publications like Wired and the New York Times. I'm a big fan of her writing, and I hope you get a chance to read and share her stuff because it's really good. Hello, Sassafras. How are you today?
I'm good. Thanks so much for having me.
Hey, thanks for coming on and joining the show. I am a fan of your writing. I think you do a terrific job. I first read your, the first article I read from you was in the New York Times about dog parks and all the risks of going to dog parks. And it's just something that I've always been telling a lot of my clients. And I was so happy to see that in a major publication like New York Times. Okay, so let me ask you, like, you know, the first question I want to ask you is just how did you learn to become a writer in the first place?
That's a great question. I guess it's kind of a big question. So I started writing in my late teens, and it kind of grew from there. It started, I started doing a lot of creative nonfiction work. I started doing some journalism for community papers, fiction work. And that was kind of the beginnings when I was in college.
Yeah. Okay. Did you study like English or like, or journalism or something like that?
I do have a master's of fine arts in creative writing, though I got that much later. I definitely... Okay. Learned sort of crafts of writing very much on the ground from other artists, from working with community publications. And that was kind of the basis for it. I wasn't a English major in college.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so what came first? Was it the writing or the dog training?
Ooh, kind of simultaneously together. Dogs have always been my biggest passion. And I got involved in dog training through sports when I was a young teenager. I was a junior handler. I was very involved in dog agility all through high school and competed very heavily in that and became very interested in dog training and enrichment and sports. And those were kind of the ideas around enrichment and positive reinforcement, where training was kind of new in the 90s, or at least mm-hmm. where I was, it felt very new. And that was very exciting to me. And so that was my first beginnings in dog training. And so then I guess dogs came first, you could say. And then okay. writing happened, and dogs and writing grew together.
Okay. So yes, I read in your Tricks in the City book that you started competing in dog sports as a teenager. And I'm thinking, you know, that is really impressive because that must have been so intimidating, right? I mean, you know, just being a teenager and, I mean, that's hard enough. And then now you're competing in dog sports around all these other people. What was that experience like?
Yeah, you know, so for me, dog training and dog agility and dog sports were really a safe haven for me. And it was a space that I was really able to find a sense of community. And it was a lot of fun. And I think that something a lot of people don't really know is that there is a really robust junior handler program that dates back. I mean, I was involved in the 90s, and it is very, very active today in all kinds of dog sports and really welcoming to kids and teens who are interested in doing fun things with their dogs, whatever sport that is. There really is a space for that.
Uh-huh. Wow. Okay. Well, you know what? That kind of makes sense. Because I remember when I started working at the Central Park Zoo, that there was a very large LGBTQ community at the zoo. And then it struck me like, oh, this makes total sense, you know, because people who have been marginalized by mainstream society, I think like they could easily relate to animals, right? And that kind of drew a lot of people working at the zoo. So it was such a great experience, just like, you know, meeting people there, meeting all types of different people, and seeing that, hey, you know what, we're all just people, we're all, you know, we're all animals. I mean, I worked with gay penguins at the Central Park Zoo, and that's a true story. People think it's made up, but it's really true. So, wow, so that makes sense when you frame it like that. Yeah, I mean, so it's a me, really it was safe community.
Well, kind of. I mean, I should probably jump in there and say that for me, uh-huh. The dog community was really a safe haven from my home life, which was very unsafe. I will say, though, and I think this is continuing to change in the dog world, I experienced a tremendous amount of homophobia in the dog world at that time, and was very not welcoming in that regard. That is shifting, but was certainly not my experience and is a part of why I try to do a lot of the work I do now.
Wow, that's great. Okay, so yes, so obviously we have a lot more work to do. Okay, all right, you know, that could be a whole nother podcast that I'll probably have to get you on to talk about at some point. But let's get back to the writing. Okay, that was a little detour. So let me ask you this other question. Like, how do you choose your material to write about? How does that happen for you?
Yeah, so I'm a full-time freelance writer. So I write predominantly about dog training and behavior and enrichment for all kinds of magazines and newspapers and web-based publications. And then I'm also an author of books. So when it comes to sort of thinking about topics that I'm going to write about, it really depends on what outlet that is going to be. So I spend a lot of time pitching ideas that I think about from just being in the world as a dog person, or that I see coming up in pop culture or in the news. So I pitch a lot of article ideas to publications, and then they either are interested or they're not. And then I also have publications that come to me asking me to write about a particular topic. So I try to really make sure that what I'm writing about is relevant to a current moment that we're in, whether it's because it's connected to, you know, something that's happening in the news or seasonally, or sometimes it's just like that dog park article you were talking about, because it's just a really present topic that is relevant to a lot of people's lives with their dogs.
Mm-hmm. You know, I've always wondered, like, you know, when I'm just writing like a blog or something, or writing a handout for our clients, I find it really hard to make kind of the science of behavior and training interesting. So how do you handle that? Like, I'd like to hear about your process. You know, is there like a certain audience you like write for? You know, I'm just kind of curious about that.
Yeah. So the audience that I'm writing for is going to be a little bit different depending on who the outlet is. And I try to really keep that in mind. So if I'm writing an article for the American Kennel Club, and I do a lot of writing for them, I can pretty much know that my audience is going to have a different baseline sort of knowledge about dogs, or they might, or at least an interest in dogs and dog training, as opposed to if I'm writing an article for a mainstream lifestyle magazine where readers might be, you know, reading about a recipe, and then they might be reading about home decor, and now they're reading about dog training. So I'm going to sort of approach it a little bit differently in that way. And when it comes to the sort of the science piece of it, I try to think about what is the core information that I really want readers to take away from that. What can they actually do with their dogs, you know, if it's about training in some way, that is going to be easy for them to digest and to take in. And so I don't actually spend a lot of time really diving into the scientific aspects of it, because I find that for most readers, it's not relevant for them or it's not interesting for them. If they want that, that's then can be a jumping off point that they can go and access that information. But when we're talking about sort of a very concise, probably under 1,000-word article, I tend to not go deep into the science.
Well, you are able to really take some confusing behavior. You know, like, for example, at the dog park, it's most people can't really tell, like, what is really good play and what's not good play. And when is that dog, like, actually saying, I've had enough. And I think it's a art and to make it make sense for the average pet guardian. And I think you do an awesome job at it. So that's great. And it's awesome because you get to reach out to a wide audience because of the publications that you do, like that have published your work. So that's great. You know, it helps to kind of educate a whole lot more people out there. How about like when you're writing, you know, for example, when you're writing like a little training plan, okay? You know, I think there's a fine line between being too technical and too detailed as opposed to being too simple, so it's kind of like, you know, are we going to split these steps or are we going to lump these steps together? So that's an art, I feel like. Can you talk a little bit about how you, you know, work through that?
Yeah. So I think that for me, I tend to really try to break down training into bite-sized pieces that people can digest. So I will try to break down if it's a training plan or a tutorial, then it's really going to be focusing on one thing. And then what are this, you know, 5 to maybe 8 steps that I can use to sort of get that behavior piece, as opposed to trying to make it a much larger concept. I try to really focus on like a small aspect of it and then bring it together for people and really center on what are the mechanics for them? What do they need to do, or what do I want them to do, right, in order to get the desired behavior, as opposed to focusing necessarily on the why in the steps. So I might, you know, so I try to keep the steps very concrete for people so they can really look at it while they're attempting this with their own dog at home.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think you do a terrific job. It just gets right to it, right? So that's great. Now, what do you do when you experience writer's block?
So writer's block, I feel like, is something that everybody deals with at some point or another. For me, I really try to write my way through it because the writing aspect is my full-time job. There is at some point kind of a point where I don't get to get writer's block. It's not an option. Exactly. So what I try to do is really focus on kind of the same concepts of if I was writing a training tutorial for somebody, but making it for myself. What are the steps I need to take to actually get this, whatever piece of writing I'm trying to work on, done, be it, you know, do I need to go do some interviews? And sometimes that can really jump me out of feeling blocked about a topic because it can help me think about it in a different way. Maybe it's I need to go back and rework the outline I had for a piece because maybe I just wasn't quite thinking about it in a way that was going to work. And so I will try to go back and work at it at a different angle. Something that's also helpful sometimes is to let it sit for a minute. And so maybe I'm going to go work on a different piece of writing right now and find some success there, find some traction with that, figure out what I'm doing, and then go back and see if I can sort of find clarity about what wasn't working. Because I tend to find, for me, writer's block tends to sit when I'm not exactly sure where a particular piece of writing is going, even if I thought I did. And so that's usually an indication for me that piece of writing is maybe going in a direction I'm not sure what that is yet.
You know, that's interesting what you said about that last part, how you, if you get stuck, you might write about something else, because it kind of sounds a little bit like actually dog training, you know, like maybe you get stuck with working on one behavior and you like, okay, let's just try something different, right? That's kind of neat. Okay. Now, now that obviously you write for like large publications like the AKC, New York Times, Bark Magazine, right? So you're reaching out to a wide audience, and so you're gonna, you know, obviously other professionals who may not agree with you, and so do you get? I'm sure you do, but you get a lot of negative feedback, and how do you deal with that?
Yeah, I think anybody at this point who's doing any kind of public content creation, writing, social media, whatever that looks like, is going to get some amount of backlash or disagreement in the world. And I think the sort of flip answer, which is sort of based in true for me, is I just don't really care. I don't really let it get to me. You had asked me earlier about sort of what came first, you know, writing or dogs, and the answer is dogs. But in terms of writing, my literary career started with writing LGBTQ fiction and writing for LGBTQ community papers. So the amount of sort of hate mail that I received doing that work definitely primed me well for when my career also spun out to be doing dog writing. I don't tend to respond to messages from people that disagree with me, from people who have a very different training philosophy than you or I might. I don't find it particularly useful to engage in that kind of debate in my comment section. I don't read the comments most of the time. And if somebody is going to take the time to send me a hateful email about, because they think that, you know, I should be training using aversives or whatever the topic might be, I don't need to respond to them. So I don't usually.
That's interesting. So you developed a thick skin early on from your life experience. And are you originally from Brooklyn too? Because I know you lived there for a little while.
Yeah, I lived in New York for about 15 years.
Okay. I was wondering if that helped you develop a thick skin too, which, you know, New Yorkers have no problem telling you what they think right to your face.
Yeah. I definitely think that, I no longer live in New York, but, I think there is part of me that will always be a New Yorker. And that is very much part of it, is that I don't really care if people like me or agree with me. I feel very confident in the work that I'm doing, and the audience that is here to have fun with their dogs and understand their dogs better, I am all about engaging with. And if folks want to do something else, then they can go and do that, but not on my time.
Okay, so let's talk about your two books, your two dog training books, right? So one is called Tricks in the City, which is published in 2019, and then the other one is called Chew This Journal, which was published in 2020. The Tricks in the City book is about trick training, and actually you talk a little bit about Charlotte, your champion trick dog. So can you tell me a little bit about your books, and you know what you were intending to do when you wrote those books and published them?
Yeah, so both of those books are really rooted in trick training, which is obviously in the title of the first one, and enrichment games, and really focused on helping people to find ways to have more fun with their dogs and to be able to be an entry point to dog sports and enrichment wherever they are, whether that be in a huge city or whether they are very geographically isolated and don't feel like there's any options for them there. And so I really, those were kind of things that were in my mind when I was writing them. And so both of the books are filled with step-by-step training games and instructions for teaching your dogs all kinds of activities, and thinking about ways that all dogs, regardless of age, past training experience, whatever behavioral issues they might have, can get involved.
Neat. I So it comes, actually, it's perfect that you sent me those books, because I recently just had a client who asked me about what kind of new tricks she can teach her dog. And I'll be completely honest, I can teach tricks, and if you showed me a trick or you showed me a recipe, I could probably follow that and really do it fine. But it's not really my forte. So when she asked me about it, I was stuck. I'm like, okay. I just kept going back to cooperative care type of behaviors, which is something that I always do. But yeah, I'm thinking that, oh, this is a perfect book for you. So I shared it with my client, and she's going to teach her dog all sorts of neat tricks in there. So how about you? Can you give us a little sample, tricks in the city? What's one of your favorite tricks, and just a little sample of what kind of steps that you might take to teach that trick?
Sure. So I don't have the book in front of me. But off the top of my head, I really think that I think think about tricks that are going to be easy for dogs and people to master. One of the things that I talk a lot about, in the book and more, globally around trick training, is this idea of the ways in which it's really effective for confidence building for both dogs, but also for people. So I got really invested in trick training as a sport, like you were mentioning, with my dog, my late dog, Charlotte, who was a Brooklyn Rescue, former street dog, had absolutely every issue you could probably think of, and also was wicked smart. And something that, I think most of us also know is that all of these dogs are very, very smart. And something that was really helpful for me with wrapping around how to support a dog with lots and lots of issues in the middle of Brooklyn was finding ways that she could be really successful and that we could be really successful together, and that I could build confidence for her and for myself that, oh, we can actually do this, whether or not, we ever solve all of, these other issues that other people might identify, right? And so one of the tricks that I found that I think is really fun and that I think is a really great beginning trick for people to teach their dogs is wave, where they are waving one or both of their front paws. I find it really, really useful for dogs that are reactive, selective, uncomfortable being in close proximity to other people, because we live in a culture where people are like, I want to pet all of the dogs. And that's not real for a lot of our dogs.
Yeah.
In fact, I have a Newfoundland. She looks like a giant teddy bear. She would rather people absolutely not crawl onto her body at all times. And I use this trick every day. It blows people's minds when I'm out in the world and people are like, can I pet your dog? And I'm like, no, but she will wave at you. And people are blown away. It creates a lovely interaction where I'm able to educate people a little bit about dogs getting to have their own boundaries, about their physical space in the world. And also, it's a really great way to help dogs build confidence that you're going to create those boundaries, support them in having those boundaries. They get to show off doing something, and then we continue on. So that's a trick that's in the book that I just about any dog can teach or can learn. Also, to sort of the conversation you were having with your client, it also does have really great cooperative care benefits as well, of being able to work on grooming, nail trimming, all of that. I find that wave and high five and those kinds of tricks have so many uses.
Yeah, because you're offering a paw for the handler. Cool. Yeah. So what would be the first step to teaching a wave?
Yeah, so I teach the wave trick very much by letting dogs puzzle out a little bit, take a treat, put it in your hand, wait while your dog sniffs and explores and nudges at you. And so what I'm really waiting for is when they start to paw at you, and that's when I would click or verbally mark that behavior. And I find most dogs catch on pretty quick.
Okay, cool. And then to get them to wave higher, are you just basically lifting your hand a little higher for them to hit your hand, or?
Yep. And so you're lifting your hand higher and higher, eventually, the more familiar with it, as they catch on to it, you can add your verbal cue and then fade out having your hand be what they're making contact with until they're just waving at air.
That's really cool. That's a great idea because, for people, for trainers who are working with a lot of fearful and anxious dogs, that is one of the biggest problems. It's like, because dogs are so freaking cute. And so people want to come up and they want to pet your dog. They want to hug your dog. They want to kiss your dog. And it's like, that's the last thing that dog wants. That could be a great way of giving them some space, just like you said. Now, can you could it work? Like, I guess it could work, right? With some dogs where you can actually tell the person to give the cue of wave and then they wave to that person, right?
Absolutely. Yep. You can make the other person cueing the behavior part of the whole experience for your dog.
Wow, that's cool. All right. I'm sure kids will get a big kick out of that too if the dog can stand and tolerate some kids being near them for a second.
Yeah, it's one of the things. Like I said, I do use it all the time with my Newfoundland who is massive. People are in awe. They want to know all about her. She does not really greet them, and it is probably the least complicated trick. She's a grand champion trick dog. It is the least complicated trick she knows, and it is by far probably the most popular trick she knows because people are just like, the dog said hi to me, the dog waved hello to me. People love it of all ages. It blows my mind every day.
That's awesome. Yeah, especially with your Newfie, they like a giant teddy bear walking down the street. They're probably a showstopper. Everybody just stops. It's like, wow, look at that dog. Okay. All right. I want to ask you a little bit more about your Chew This Journal. But before we head to that, let me, because you mentioned Charlotte earlier. Okay. And you mentioned how the trick training helped build her confidence. So that was one of, what role can trick training play to help dogs like Charlotte with a lot of fear and anxiety? Can you expand on that a little bit more?
Yeah. So the use of trick training, I think, is really effective in conjunction with whatever other behavioral modification training is going on for people. So I really encourage dog trainers to think about how to incorporate trick training into the other work that you're doing. I find that it is really helpful, like I was saying, both for dogs and people. For dogs, it's helping to give them something else to do. So if you're talking about, working with dogs who are really reactive, anxious, aggressive, whatever that looks like for them, being able to give people something else to do with their dog in the world is really useful. So we're going to do a four-on trick. So they're going to go up onto a rock or a park bench or whatever environmental obstacles exist on your walk. And suddenly you're able to move your dog out of the way, re-engage your dog in a different activity. And so that whatever trigger is happening over here can pass. That's one way that I find really helpful to, use those trick skills in very practical ways that also gives people a lot of confidence and also helps people have more fun. I think that something that's, I certainly experienced absolutely knowing better and then for sure adopting a dog that had a million issues and that I see a lot with people who have dogs who have issues. It happens. Is that all they're focused on is working on solving this quote unquote problem behavior. And it can be very easy to forget how to just have fun with your dog. And I find that trick training is really, really effective for giving people bite-sized pieces of things they can do that they can have fun with. They might not be able to go to a scent work class with their dog. That might not be realistic for their dog now or maybe ever, but they can play games at home with their dog. They can work on these skills that can give their dog and them confidence when they're out moving around in the world together. And it's also a competitive sport that people can do from home via video, which if they're at all interested in that, can also be a really fun introduction for helping people find ways to channel the mental and physical energy that their dog might have when they feel like maybe other exercise outlets, especially for city dogs, maybe aren't accessible to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember you wrote in your book about how that was a perfect activity for Charlotte, because she wouldn't do well in a format where you're in person around a whole bunch of other dogs and people. So that was a perfect thing for you to do with your with Charlotte, like an anxious and fearful dog who somehow found a way in the city. And that was a part of the reason why you actually moved out of the city, correct?
Yeah. So we adopted Charlotte. We were she was a southern. She was brought up from the Carolinas to New York, like so many dogs. We lived in a 101 unit building in Brooklyn. That was a hard match for a very dog reactive dog. We then moved to outer Brooklyn to have a very small yard, but it was a yard, and that was great. And then she developed very, very severe, it worsened over time, phobias to thunder. In particular to barometric pressure changes. And she was medication resistant. She was on working on every behavioral medication we could give her around that phobia. And at the same time, my Newfoundland tore both the ligaments in both of her knees and needed rehab surgery for that. We met with surgeons in New York, and the answer was, maybe you should think about, could we move? And so because Charlotte at that point with her storm phobia in New York with the many thunderstorms that we had really required round the clock supervision if there was any chance that storms could happen. And so we moved cross country with three dogs and three cats for the big dogs. So my Newf had surgery 2 weeks after we got to the West Coast, and Charlotte, I think, only experienced one or two more thunderstorms the rest of her life. And that was
Oh, great. I'm glad to hear that her quality of life improved out there. Yeah. Okay. I think also you made a great point about having fun with trick training, right? Because when you are working on behavior modification, you know, so many people, they're worried about their dog, you know, lunging out and exploding. They're worried about their, you know, being embarrassed by their dog. You hear them, you know, saying like, sit, come, stay, you know, down, you know, and then you ask him, well, hey, ask your dog to do a high five or shake paw, and all of a sudden their tone shifts to like, oh, shake, you know, give me paw, right? So that's such a wonderful point about trick training, that to add that into your behavior modification plan, to make sure that training is fun, because that's, you know, right? That's the bottom line, is like, make it fun, then your dog will want to work with you more. Okay, let's talk about your other book, Chew This Journal, which is a book of activities, okay? So tell me about that book and about some of the favorite activities that you've included in that book.
Yeah, so Chew This Journal really brings together all kinds of activities, from crafts to training games that people can do with their dogs. And I was really thinking about ways that people, kind of to this point, can have fun being with, spending quality time with their dogs. And so some of the activities are just purely fun and are like making holiday ornaments or things like that, and instructions for doing that. But there's a training component that's sort of woven into a lot of the activities in the book, and fun challenges that people can do with their dogs. So one of my favorite is the pause up challenge that's in there, that kind of I was talking about before also, is, you know, teaching people to teach their dogs to put two paws up or to put all four paws up onto all kinds of objects. And then in the book, there's the instructions for how to teach that by, you know, luring dogs up and then building fluency in that behavior. And then also a challenge component of when you're on your walk, whether it's in your suburban neighborhood, in your, you know, in inner city, whatever it is, looking for different safe, stable obstacles, whatever that is, and turning your world into, or your dog's world into a bit of a parkour experience. So finding different things that dogs can engage with. And I find that it's both very fun for dogs and people. It also builds confidence in dogs who may be worried or have sort of environmental stressors when they're out. It's giving them something to focus on. It can also be very useful for creating space and distance from triggers for dogs who maybe are also struggling with reactivity or anxiety when out on walks. And so the book is filled with different kinds of games and crafts and those kinds of activities that you can do either at home or in your neighborhood with your dog.
It's great and very helpful because I think all of us, right, we kind of get into this routine with our own dogs, or even as professionals, you kind of, doing what I do, where I'm only working with basically like kind of a certain segment of the dog population, which are the behaviorally challenged ones. I kind of have my go-to exercises and activities, and sometimes you kind of get stuck. Quite frankly, you get stuck. So it was really refreshing. I'm like, oh, I was looking at the book. I'm like, oh, I gotta do this. I gotta remember to do this. I used to do this, but I totally forgot about doing this now. So for the listeners out there, like, maybe you've been doing this for a long time, but just checking this book out will kind of spark some of that creativity for you again. I think it's wonderful. So cool. How many activities do you have in there? It was a lot.
It's 200 pages. I don't have it in front of me, but there's 200 pages of activities in there. I can't remember the exact count, but it has all kinds of things, lots of scent-based games, all kinds of, foundation games that can be used for teaching dogs, more complicated sports and activities in the future, but are just fun things that really anybody can do with dogs.
Mm-hmm. I love how in both your books you were right, like, have fun, but don't forget, don't break the law. Be safe. Did you get any situations where people wrote you like maybe the dog did something, like just ran off after a bunny or something, like they had dog off leash in the wrong place at the wrong time?
Yeah, I feel like something that I try to do is to whatever content I'm creating is I really try to sort of build in those reminders to people around being respectful both of other dogs and people in spaces and thoughtful about their own dog's safety. It's something, that I definitely get cringy about of, I'm all about people following, keeping their dogs leashed and keeping them safe. And so I try to work that in a fun way and also include reminders like, please don't have your dog do a parkour bounce off of like a memorial in a park, like things that like I watch people do. And I'm like, that's not helping to create a culture that appreciates dogs as much as we do. So let's be thoughtful.
Yes. Now let me ask about fan mail. Okay. So I did ask you about, when you get negative mail, but what about fan mail? How does that make you feel? Are there certain, letters or emails that you receive in your life that you kind of have stuck with you?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think, we were talking about, hate mail earlier, and honestly, I'm so lucky. I feel like I receive so little hate. Honestly, it surprises me for what I think I anticipate I'll get, especially if I write something that was a little more hot button of a dog topic. I honestly get very little, and what I do get is pretty easy to ignore. But what I am so lucky to get is just so many wonderful messages and emails and letters from readers who have seen my work somewhere and found it useful. And I love that and have found ways to incorporate it and improve the lives of their dogs in some way, or improve their life with their dogs in some way and have more fun with them and understand them better. And that's something that I absolutely love to see, is people who, think that their dog is maybe only one thing, that their dog is the sum of their behavioral issues, and they are able to start to see that maybe their dog will never be quote unquote cured, and that that's okay, that their dog is still wonderful and that they can still do things that they both enjoy together. And those are the kinds of messages that I especially love.
That's great. It must be so fulfilling to hear like that when you do make a difference for people and their dogs because of, you know, just something you're right about. I think that's a powerful tool. Okay. But you don't only write about dogs. You also write about cats as well.
I do.
Yeah. So is there a difference in like how you write about cats and dogs? Is there, do you find like dog people and cat people are different and you have to kind of change your style of writing about the different animals there?
To some extent, I think that animal people are animal people, and that there's sort of this, you know, some extent sort of like fictional divide of cat people and dog people. And there's a lot of people that are both or who are, you know, open to whatever. I do think, you know, I've written about cats for about as long as I've written about dogs. A lot of people who know my dog work have no idea I write about cats. I think cat people generally know I'm a dog person that is also a cat person. So I think in that way, like, yes. But in terms of the actual sort of like writing about, you know, training cats or engaging with cats or understanding cat behavior, I don't think there's really a difference in that my focus is really to be as accessible as possible, to break down whether it's, you know, cat body language or, you know, how to teach a cat, to do a particular behavior or to work through, you know, starting to work through a different, you know, behavioral issue somebody might be having in the home, like their cat jumping on the counter or something. You know, for me, it's really no different than writing about dogs. It's like, how can I break this down into steps that people understand without getting really caught up in sort of larger concepts of sort of the science behind things that the average cat person like does not care. They're just like, I would just like my cat to not be on the counter and stealing my dinner. How do I solve that? So I try to really focus in on like, I have somebody's attention. You know, we live in a fast paced world. I get it. You know, people are, you know, scrolling TikTok, they're scrolling Instagram. They want a quick answer. And I think that something that sometimes, whether it's cats or dogs, that folks who train using, you know, positive reinforcement methodologies sometimes get stuck in is that we're pitted against sort of like the quick fix solution of aversive folks or folks who use aversives. And we don't do ourselves any favors, I don't find, or at least I don't in my work, by getting overly complicated for people. That at that point, people have glazed over, they have scrolled on to the next thing. And the next thing might be a method that is going to be really harmful for their cat or dog. So if I can make my method as quick and easy for people to at least start to understand whether or not they're going to have like a solution right away, that's what I try to do.
Yeah. And like I said before, I think you do a really great job because that's a talent. It's to put in a lot of information in a short period of time, especially for the out world now where, yes, it's like, if you don't give it to me in 30 seconds or less, I'm done. I'm gone. So what are some of the biggest misconceptions about behavior, animal behavior and training that you feel passionately about addressing through your writing?
Yeah, I mean, I think some of the big stuff that I think we're all, or at least I know I'm really focused on, is the ways and is kind of to what I was just talking about, sort of that quick fix promise that I think is very, very prevalent and very attractive to people on the internet, and sort of helping people dive in really quickly and understanding that just because somebody is promising they can fix it, you know, whatever that behavioral it is, really diving into what are they doing. And so with that, sort of my other sort of hot topics with is, you know, aversive tools for sure. It's something that's a huge issue in the dog, you know, amongst dog guardians that we're seeing. And unfortunately, we're seeing sort of this, I think, hotbed sort of resurgence of it, certainly in the States, online, TikTok, Instagram. So talking about that for people that don't know any better. And I think that's one of the things is thinking people only know what they know. And so helping people to understand that better. And then also something that's sort of behavioral, really a big passion of mine is that it's okay for dogs to not be perfect. I think that we live in this culture right now that is very much social media fed and, you know, of this like snapshot of perfection, of this idea that dogs are sort of walking, you know, occasionally barking stuffed animals and that that is what a good dog is. And so really for me is reframing for people this idea of your dog's a good dog if they don't like other dogs. Your dog is still a good dog if they don't like other people, like, or don't like people coming into your house. Like there are ways we can, you know, work on training and management and all of that stuff. But really for me, it's about reframing this idea of what a good dog is and what a dog is. And that a lot of the behavioral problems that people are really struggling with, and not to in any way diminish the struggle that they're feeling about that, are also just in some ways what dogs have been bred to be. And that what the, where the conflict arises are the expectations that we're putting on them in our sort of modern expectation of what equals a good dog, or what, you know, what looks like a good dog on Instagram, and why isn't my dog, you know, this totally bomb-proof potato with fur?
Yeah, I mean, that's such a great point, because, I mean, how many times have you heard someone say or write you in an email, you know, asking for your services that my dog is a really sweet dog, my dog is a really good dog, but ... right? And it's I just want people to feel like, you know, they're just like you said, they're all great dogs, you know, they're just doing doggy things that, you know, humans find that unacceptable for one reason or not, but it doesn't mean that, oh, they're a bad dog, that they're a risky dog, a dangerous dog. It's I love that you mentioned that and that you are trying to spread that word, just to see that, you know, the dogs don't need to be perfect.
No, and I think that sometimes people get stuck in this idea too of that it's the dog that has to change, as opposed to recognizing maybe it's our expectations or the way we manage our dog in the world or in our home or whatever, that actually we need to shift how we're doing things to make our dogs more comfortable. But that our dogs don't have to fit into this sort of like cookie cutter idea of what we think equals a good dog or a good relationship with our dog. And so finding ways that people can enjoy the time they have with their dog within the sort of parameters of who their dog is as an individual, because, you know, they get a say in it.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I think that's a great place to wrap up there. I really want to thank you for what you do, because, you know, your work is, you're reaching millions of people out there. So it's so important, you know, and so I don't take it lightly that you're writing good quality, pieces out there that can reach a lot of people and teach people and hopefully change, you know, what their expectations are, what they think about dogs and behavior.
Well, thank you so much.
Okay, so Sassafras, where can people find you?
So you can find me online at sassafraslowry.com or on social media, Facebook, Twitter, or X, I guess, as we're calling it, and Instagram at sassafraslowry, and also on Instagram at Sirius the Bear, which is my dog's Instagram, but where a lot of my training content lives.
Oh, seriously, that's a newfie.
That's my newfie, yep.
That would make sense. Awesome. So I'll make sure I have all those up on the show notes. Awesome. I'll also include links to some of your pieces for people who haven't had the pleasure of reading you yet. They can get a little taste of it. Okay, so thank you again for your time. It was a pleasure speaking to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hey, animal lovers. Thank you for joining us. If you enjoyed what you heard and like to learn more, please follow us on Facebook or visit www.behaviorvet.com. We have much more cool stuff for you if you'd like to keep geeking out on companion animal behavior with the Behavior Vets team. Come back soon and join us on our journey to make life better for the animals in your life. Thanks again for listening. Remember to have hope because real change is possible and we can achieve it together. Enjoy our podcast, but this is a reminder that the contents of this podcast are for educational and entertainment purposes only. The comments and advice are never intended to be a substitute for seeing a behavior professional or a credentialed veterinarian in person. While the content is always intended to help people receive the best possible behavior support for their pets, any information you utilize from this podcast is at your own risk.